Thank you. It's very nice to be here and see so many smiling faces in the sunshine. And this is summer to me, so it's really nice to be here, especially. I'd like to begin by thanking the Pacific Center for Technology and Culture for inviting me here, in particular Mary Louise and Arthur Croker and my friend Brad. Thank you for your kind introduction. I was asked several times by Brad whether I would need any sort of special things like high-tech equipment or, so you're not even doing a PowerPoint? It's like, no, not even doing a PowerPoint. I'm kind of old-fashioned in that. So here as we sit in the belly of high-tech, what I'll present to you is decidedly low-tech. It's just words, but words, I think, are, as McLuhan said, are our first or our primary technology. So with that, I'll begin with a quotation from the first, or at least an abiding book. Out of the ground, the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. The names of every living creature pass from Adam's lips, but more than their names. He speaks their essence. He speaks the language of nature, of being, a grammar of the multitude. In Eden, we are invited to imagine a mythical unity of word and thing in the divine logos. This metaphysical power belongs to Adam until the fall, whereupon the naked text of the world becomes inscrutable. Names, a pale representation of things. This is how the old-fashioned grammarians from Augustine to Erasmus and Bacon would have understood this passage from Genesis. Their central insight was that through exegesis, one might read in the words a lost language of being, and through this art, to reconstruct a nature from which we have been exiled. Exegesis saves. Should hear the pun. What I'll offer you today is, admittedly, a fragmentary beginning, some reflections on the contemporary idea of life as it is emerging in a number of disparate spheres. My approach is rhetorical. That is, I'm interested in the ways that we speak about life and how this idea circulates in discourses from the sacred to the scientific. I began with the book of Genesis because so often we take refuge in a myth of origins in foundationalist discourses. So how might we formulate the question of life, of bios itself? The challenge is not simply to locate the concept within a history of ideas, as Foucault says, but to, quote, discern beneath them how one or another object could take shape as a possible object of knowledge, end quote. How is it then that life itself has become an object to be discussed, known, controlled, and maximized, preserved, or even ransomed and bartered? And more importantly, whose life is at stake in these questions? How, for instance, does war succeed in conflating the life of the nation with my life, such that the following logically contradictory slogan immediately makes some kind of perverse sense to us? Quote, go get slaughtered, and we promise you a long and pleasant life. End quote. Again, that's Foucault. But I think it's tremendously apropos today. Certainly the life that is slaughtered and simultaneously preserved cannot logically coincide. And yet the one who receives this command or promise is meant to understand a deeper truth in life, notwithstanding the fact that he or she has but one life to give. These are undoubtedly different ways of speaking of life, and it is not at all obvious that the singular life that is mine can or ought to be mapped onto a collective national life, a political life deemed to be universal. And so we also resort to a myth of origins here when we speak of life and privilege the individual as foundation, or conversely, when we privilege the group as foundation, whether we call this the polis, the nation, the state, or a people. And how do you begin to map the constellation of that hybrid term biotechnology? what is the relation here, where is the life in this term, and what is the relation between its terms, theos, techne, and logos. I think that if we are to understand the term biotech, it demands another kind of thinking, one that privileges no term as foundational. It is precisely the relation between bias and techne that is at issue, between life and art, nature and culture, between being and human symbolization, or between words and things. There is no access to a pure language, a language of essences, or a divine logos, and yet every technology, this is debatable, I admit, but every technology would gloss over this difference and close this gap, whether this involves ever more powerful microscopes to penetrate the secrets of life, or whether it means inventing a new lexicon through genomic or proteomic sequencing, for instance, to provide an interpretive grid or a code by which we might inch closer to the original language of being. My preamble. I'd like to start here with Foucault's work from the 1970s and the conception of life captured by what he calls biopolitics. In simple terms, the relationship between political order and bios, or life. I suspect that this will be familiar terrain for a lot of people, so I'll be relatively brief here. Famously, Foucault charts the movement from a classical mode of sovereignty to a modern biopolitical one, a biopolitics that has become the purview of the state. Classically, then, sovereignty was conceived under Roman law as the patria potestas, as Foucault says, the power of the family father who enjoyed, quote, the right to dispose of the life of his children and his slaves, end quote. This power is summed up in the following formula. Foucault boils it down to a pithy statement. Quote, to take life or let live. To take life or let live. These were the options. Here it was the sovereign's prerogative whether to revoke the life of his subjects or to allow them to live. In an argument that I, of course, can't duplicate here, Foucault claims that this classical model of sovereignty has, in the last two centuries, come to be supplanted by a different model in which the state explicitly and implicitly seizes control over life. Today, Foucault argues, the sovereign state exercises a control over life, which takes the distinct form of regulating life and maximizing it, and so we get the state involved and deeply invested in the population's birth and death rates, aging, disease, hygiene, public health and welfare, pro-life policies, and so on. So while the classical patria potestas, classical model of sovereignty can be summed up by the formula which I give you, to take life or let live, modern biopolitical state sovereignty has its own formula in parallel with this, and that's, quote, the power to make live and let die. So you should hear the shift occurring here between from the classical to the modern, specifically from taking life to making life, and from letting live to letting die. So you hear the movement, the different shift in this concept of life. In the modern formulation, life has changed, I think, and it is no longer presumed as something there to be taken, as it was by the family father, but as that which must be produced and constantly tended, manufactured, even. Life is now swept up in a discourse produced in and through a state discourse. We must be made to live. We are subjects whose lives are manufactured and whose livingness becomes indexed by our regulation, our control, our normativization, and the ways in which we're administrated by the state. So now the argument goes, each human life counts merely as one biopolitical entity among a mass of others, among what Foucault calls man as species, so subject to statistical control concerning rates of birth and death, as I said, reproductive and economic productivity, marriage laws, and the like. The individual is here displaced and becomes, quote, as Foucault says, regularized by a technology in which bodies are replaced by general biological processes. End quote. This is a rather grim depiction of life, biopoliticized, biomechanized, reduced to bare biological processes. But it is not Foucault's final word. on life. I'd like to turn now to Foucault's late work on ethics or ethical life, and I hope to show that herein lies a theory of the living subject that is perhaps not so firmly fettered to biopolitical state regulation. There's a possibility for refusal in a sense. The stakes are high because what is at issue is the formulation of a new or a different model of subjectivity, which has implications for the way we conceive of life in the contemporary scene. Some critics have been frustrated by Foucault's ethics because it is doggedly non-prescriptive. Instead, his ethics, and by ethics is his final period from around 1979 until his death in 1984. Most people don't focus on that late Foucault. Foucault's ethics unfolds through a discussion of subjective life and what he has notoriously called, after Socrates, the care of the self. The ethical care of the self is found in the relationship the subject has with herself, with what he calls the self-self relation, rapport à soi. This is the relation in which the self cares for itself, not egoistically, but also in relation to a social, a wider socio-political network. Here, the self strives to craft a better self, strives to reinvent, as it were, the very terms of its own subjectivity, to become other than what it is in the present, and to escape those biopolitical modes of control that provide a clear framework within which the subject can be identified. Foucault mentions Socrates as an example because it is through Socrates' self-care that he is and he will be in a position to care for others in the polis. It is Socrates' self-consistency, then, that makes his life an admirable model and a touchstone for ethical life in general. This is maybe why we still read of Socrates. There is a specific reflexivity, and an odd one, I admit, operating here in the self-self relation, a reflexivity that relies on work and self-transformation. And we must insist that this reflexivity is not cognitive, it's not ideational, it's not rationally or conceptually grounded. So there's an agency that emerges in our ethical self-relation, but the question is, how do we understand that agency? The self that Foucault has in mind here, the self that relates to itself in its own proper project of an ethical life, is decidedly not the kind of subject that we have inherited from modern philosophies of the subject since at least Descartes. It is, in fact, something new for our culture. But how do we get a grip on the relation between these two selves, as it were, the self that crafts itself? I think it's misleading to think of these two selves as temporal abstractions, say, the now self and the future self. While this might be tempting, we fall into a trap here because there is a necessary ambivalence between the two selves. How do we know which is the true source of our agency, or which is properly prior, or which will actually take responsibility for our self-transformation? How do we know which self should orchestrate the ethical work on the self? We might ask ourselves, is it the now self that decides, or should we, it's also a way of speaking that sounds a bit crazy, right? I mean, I have to admit that this kind of discussion that we have with ourselves in moments of ethical crisis, it's not just straightforwardly deploying a received canon or a received morality and saying, oh, I should do this, I should do that. It's the kind of conversation that we have inside with ourselves when we're in a moment of crisis. What should I do? This is the self I have to be and have to become. So it's the self that questions itself. It's a critical self. Even saying we have to ask ourselves, the rhetoric there is key. We might ask ourselves, is it the now self that decides, or should we not insist that it is the future self that solicits my actions, the future self that issues a kind of ethical injunction from the future for me right now to work on myself and to become other than what I am? It's certainly not obvious that the vector of our action or our desire here flows in a linear sort of temporality. Doesn't the now self, after all, take its bearings and derive its meaning and its implicit relation to a future self, as Heidegger would say, for instance? Moreover, is the now self well and truly in the now? Because at the moment of my saying it and thinking it, is it not already past? Is it not already determined through my speech and through my thought? So if it is true that the now self is evanescent and forever slipping from me, never quite mine, never quite where I am in my delayed moment of knowing and speaking, then the philosophical subjectivity that we happily bestow on it is misplaced, because our philosophy comes too late, always a moment behind. So the upshot of this is that we're at a loss to say with certainty which self is really mine and within my power, because the two selves never fully coincide. I would say this is the very condition of ethical life and ethical questioning. So I said a second ago that these two selves, thinking of these two selves in such temporal terms, is misleading. But it's not only this linear notion of time that trips us up or makes us come too late or arrive too early. We get tripped up because we imagine the two selves here as fixed or static terms, and then presume that to get from A to B, a certain distance must be traveled and a certain time used up. To put it another way, when we have a fixed conception of the terms, two selves, as points in time or space, then we imagine that the relation between them proceeds from these two terms themselves. Nothing could be further from the truth. Rather, Foucault conceives of these selves, these terms, as constituted in the relation itself. So the relation itself is primary. Each self is then a placeholder or a pole in the complex relation that obtains between the terms. It would be better to suggest that the self occupies a kind of field, that it is a tensile and dynamic extendedness of becoming which happens between the two poles of the relation. And the relation itself is always in flux. Here I'd like to give you a metaphor that's not mine. It's from Brian Massumi's book, Parables for the Virtual. I found it rather persuasive, because this metaphor works, because the kind of language that I'm using, this ordinary language, is difficult. We end up sort of reinscribing a grammatical subject, an action, a verb, with the verb that does the action, and an object that takes that action. It becomes very directed, and that, I think, that trips us up as well. The metaphor is a soccer metaphor, and Massumi deploys it tactfully. Massumi asks us to consider a soccer game, and he says, quote, put two teams on a grassy field with goals at either end, and you have an immediate, palpable tension. End quote. He theorizes the field of play then not in a literal sense as a grassy field, but metaphorically as what he calls a tensile force field activated by the presence of bodies within the signed limits. In his reading, the player cannot be conceived as a traditional philosophical subject who would act autonomously or rationally on the basis of some conceptual end or telos. The player is not the subject of action in a strict sense, he says, because she is a node in the complex relation taking place in or on the field of play, immediately, imminently, in relation to her teammates, in relation to the opposing team, in relation to where every player is situated in or on the field, and not least in relation to where the ball is situated in this nexus. The player lives these relations in real time. Her body is geared into, as Merleau-Ponty would say, geared into the myriad potential plays that are always opening before her, and she immediately senses the trajectories of every term in play, not just where the ball is right now and where it's going. So to this future orientation, we would have to add her past experience as well, the concretion of failures and victories, her self-knowledge, and the immediate understanding she has built up concerning the capacities of each of her players on her team, each of her teammates. Perhaps she knows the opposing team, knows that they won the last three games, knows that she has the home field advantage, knows that their star player is recovering from a knee injury, and so on. I mean, all of these things are immediately taken up and deployed in a bodily sort of knowledge, an immediate knowledge. Everything's in flux here. And none of this, as I said, is conceptual. It's sort of grounded in the body. So just as the player is not a traditional subject, we have to add something else to that, and that the ball here is not a traditional object to be handled. We might even reverse the relation and say that the players do not play with the ball in so much as the ball plays with them. The ball ends up being a catalytic force, what Masumi calls a quasi-object, and the players, as it were, borrow its kinetic energy as their own, its agency as theirs. As Masumi writes, the player's body is a node of expression. A good game, then, as we know, has very little to do with the technical expertise of each individual player, strictly speaking. And what we might say that the rules of the game provide the ontological conditions of play, it's also true that a strict obedience to these rules, even with supreme technical competence, will make for a lackluster performance. Every sports fan knows this, right? Importantly, there's an aesthetic component which Masumi calls style. I love this. He says it's more than the mere perfection of technique. So there's a surplus value, we might say. I agree about with his analysis of style. And I see in the term style a wonderful resonance with Foucault, to come back to him, with Foucault's ethics and the kind of relational subjectivity that we see in the self-self relation, right? Foucault suggests that in the subject's relation to herself, there must be a style, a manner in which the relation is lived as a vital force, the mode in which self-transformation proceeds, not technically according to strict rules or according to given grammars of self-expression, but rather her self-transformation is realized stylistically through what Foucault calls a style of life, a mode de vie. For Masumi, it is the star player on the team who maximizes this aesthetic style. He writes, the star player is one who modifies expected mechanisms of channeling field potential. The star plays against the rules, but not by breaking them. In other words, the star player bends it like Beckham, right? Bends the rules and the ball itself enough to make a difference in the play, really putting into play and realizing a potentiality that is implicit in the field nexus. Extending Masumi's analysis, if the ball is the intersection, we might say, of multiple vectors of potentiality that the star player catalyzes and realizes, a surcharge node in the field of play, we might also call the ball a technology of sorts. The ball is that technology, I think, that allows for a relational transformation, insofar as it this ball, this technology, catalyzes a nexus of potential. In a psychoanalytic vein, it's a site of sublimation, I think. We might talk about that afterwards. After all, no ball, no game, right? So the ball is essential, as an essential technology to the game. Similarly, in Foucault again, ethical self-transformation, I think, relies on technologies to provide the catalytic vehicle for styles of life. We might think of how we work on the body through physical exercise, you know, on those horrible machines at the gym, or the project of writing, whether it's academic or personal, and the distinction between the two is for grabs as well. The project of critique or engaging in political demonstration, social reform, all of these are today what we might call technologies of the self in the project of an ethical life. So at this juncture, I think we have a grammar of sorts, or at least a metaphor to draw on, a metaphor and a grammar of sorts with which we can turn to the recent work of Paolo Verno, whom I read as extending Foucault's ethics in an explicitly political direction, and an interesting one at that. Verno's book is one that's translated into English. It's The Grammar of the Multitude. It's a very short three lectures, actually, published last year by Semiotext. From the sports metaphor I gave you, we can see that what's at stake here is now not just a new conception of subjectivity, as that player as a subject, or no longer as a post-subject, but also a new form of social and political collectivity, team, the teams, the sports fans, the whole network that supports the game, including Coca-Cola and all of those corporate sponsors as well. So we have to think here that what's at stake is not just a new subjectivity, but a new form of political collectivity and a new form of collective agency. This is where Virno comes in. Virno works to theorize this collectivity. Like Foucault and like names that will be familiar to you likely, Michael Hart and Antonio Negri, with whom Virno is in dialogue, Virno tries to carve a space outside of traditional conceptions of sovereignty, whether this means the sovereignty of the philosophical subject or the sovereignty of the state. So he's critical, and Hart and Negri as well, critical of the Hobbesian notion of the state, which theorizes a process of civilization in which the individual gives up an originally chaotic state of nature to submit himself to the sovereign, right? So the story goes, even though he surrenders his freedom and agency, he does so, according to Hobbes, in order to gain the protection of belonging to that collective unity we call the people, right? Virno is very critical of the people because he sees it as too categorical. He sees the people as violently collapsing the distinctions between individuals in the name of the sovereign. So the individual, under the rubric of the people, must now do the sovereign's bidding and is alienated, as it were, from his own desire. The problem here, and it's a problem for all of us, not just Virno, the problem is to imagine a form of unity, political unity, that honors and preserves rather than collapses the distinctions between individuals. And so against this modern Hobbesian concept of the people, we have Hart, Negri, and Virno proposing a collective form of life they call the multitude, from Spinoza's Multitudo. The multitude, Virno declares, does not clash with the one, rather it redefines it. It redefines the unity rather than clashing it with it. In effect, Virno turns Hobbes on his head. The one or the unity is no longer a promised point of convergence in the future, or in the figure of the sovereign or of the state, as it is for Hobbes. The movement is not from some state of nature, as it is in Hobbes, towards civilization. Instead, for Virno, the multitude is a kind of premise, a kind of origin, which does not transfer rights to the sovereign. In a Marxian vein, he calls it the base. It is the universal. It is the generic. It is the shared experience. These are all his terms. And it is in the shared commonality of the multitude that we can imagine a new kind of agency for social and political transformation, an agency that does not have its source in an outmoded subject or in the sovereignty of the state. The multitude is a biosocial collectivity, a life form that is irreducible to its content. The title of Virno's book is A Grammar of the Multitude, as I said, and Virno does offer us a grammar of sorts, though to be sure, it is not a foundational grammar, it's not a divine logos, it is not language in the ordinary sense. It's nothing like the book of Genesis, in other words. His argument is itself multitudinous. That is, it's a kaleidoscope of argumentational fragments, a bricolage employing key terms, as he says himself, from Hobbes, Kant, Heidegger, Aristotle, Marx, and Freud, and drawing equally on the vastly disparate insights of Hannah Arendt, Glenn Gould, the novelist Luciano Bianciardi, Saussure, Guy Debord, and this list is by no means complete. So his argument is inductive rather than deductive because it draws on all of these areas. But the argument does have the force of the multitude behind it, I would say. The subtitle of the book is For an Analysis of Contemporary Forms of Life. And it is here, I think, with the form of life and with the emergence of a kind of life itself that I find the most compelling insights. If the multitude offers us a grammar of sorts, a new grammar of sorts, a language which Virno characterizes as pre-individual, this has a direct bearing on how contemporary forms of life are emerging. So what then can we make of Virno's grammar? Interestingly, Virno appeals to Aristotle's rhetoric and to the role of topos in Aristotle. Topos literally means place, and it is commonly translated as topics. I suggest that we think here of this place as the kind of field that we saw in the earlier metaphor. It's a kind of field of play. Now, as Virno points out, in Aristotle there are two kinds of topics, the common topics and the specific topics. Aristotle's distinction between the common and the specific topics is key here. The common topics, or often called commonplaces, are a shared communal means of invention. They are inherently a creative or poetic force behind language and meaning, what an audience would commonly draw upon or agree upon as generally accepted, as opposed to the specific topics which are used in specific arguments. Court of law, for instance, has its own sort of specific way of speaking. Common topics are presumably universal. The common topics might be understood, and this is in my switch to sort of a rhetorical analysis here, the common topics might be understood as that which underwrites an argument, the relational force behind an argument, even the movement behind it. You might think of them as the engine of a trope, that which is the creative force behind a trope which literally means a turn of phrase, right? You might say then that the common topics are that which makes a phrase turn. Very generally, tropes are words that mean more than or something other than their literal meaning. Metaphor, irony, metonymy, and synecdoche are the four sort of master tropes, classically anyway. So tropes are words that mean more than or something other than their literal meaning. And the argument goes, it's the common topics that make for this figural meaning as opposed to the literal, even a deviation from the literal. So take John Donne's metaphor, no man is an island, or take the popular metaphor, life is a beach. And we see immediately that the meaning is not simply conceptual or rational here, but it is instead also deeply figurative or poetic, depending on how we read it and hear it, right? And how it's spoken. It's not what's said, it's how that thing is said. So what's really important is not just the literal meaning, but we also have to take into account the rhetorical context and who is reading and how they're reading it. And this makes for the wonderful complication of language. The theorist Paul de Man has made this point, and I think it's significant to my argument here, because if both literal and figurative meanings are woven into our language, how do we tell the difference? In other words, what authorizes us, what gives us the power to judge the truth of the literal over the figurative, or vice versa, depending on the situation? De Man writes, and I quote, "The grammatical model of the question becomes rhetorical not when we have on the one hand a literal meaning and on the other hand a figurative meaning, but when it is impossible to decide by grammatical or other linguistic devices which of the two meanings prevails." He concludes, "Rhetoric radically suspends logic and opens up vertiginous possibilities of referential aberration." Vertiginous possibilities of referential aberration, end quote. So without an appeal to a sovereign authority or to a convention that operates foundationally, a myth of origins, we are forced into a profound ambivalence, whether we have to read something literally or figuratively. And I think this ambivalence has a resonance with the kind of ambivalence we saw in Foucault's ethical subject, because I think the subject's relation to herself in an ethical moment is also informed rhetorically. Remarkably then, rhetoric works to suspend sovereign logics, and in so doing displaces the subject who speaks or who reads from the position of an authoritative knower. This points us again to a field of potential signification, where the common topics put a referential aberration into play, ensuring that meaning is constituted rhetorically and that it is irreducible to its grammatical or linguistic foundations. As I said, at play here is not what language says. After all, we can't know except through other linguistic reference, but more precisely, what is at play is what language does and how it does it, how something is said. And I think this gets to the heart of McLuhan's little aphorism, the medium is the message, right? The medium itself, the way something is said, it carries the message, informs the message. There's no message that has a content that's abstractable from the medium. Significantly, so for Virno, significantly, he privileges the common topics, and in so doing, privileges the rhetorical conditions of language. So he's hammering away at precisely how it is that language does what it does, and how it works as a technology, how we use it, how we live it, how it informs our lives, and most importantly for my argument here, how language is the substance of our relations, how it is that insubstantial substance of our communication and our commonality. Virno calls this language, this rhetorical language, the life of the mind, or borrowing a term from Marx, the general intellect, a common and shared source of knowledge, a shared form of life. For Virno, this common sphere includes shared linguistic and communicative faculties, but also, and it's a long list, I have to say, ethics, aesthetic tastes, affects, emotions, and contemporary post-Fordist or post-assembly line conditions of human labor, where he analyzes these as this kind of labor as consuming life, whereas the assembly line labor ended at, from 5 o'clock or something. All of these are the vital conditions that inform our biosocial being in common, the being in common of the multitude, while at the same time ostensibly respecting the myriad singularities that make up this multitude. Language and tropes here work for Virno much like the quasi-subjectivity of the ball in the soccer metaphor, polarizing our bodily and intellectual tasks, enabling a field of play, and reinventing, or at least giving us the possibility of reinventing, the terms of our relation. Admittedly, this is highly abstract, so to conclude, I'd like to tie together a few threads of my discussion and leave you with a couple of instances in which we might see something like the subjectivity of the multitude emerging, the agency of the multitude.